What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense, progressive news without the boring parts. I'm John Wiener. Today we'll be talking about Hillary with Tom Frank. He says her longstanding involvement with microfinance is the wrong way to help poor women around the world. Also, we'll look at independent voters. Both Bernie and Donald Trump have recruited lots of them, but are independents really the key to winning the presidency this year? Joshua Holland has some facts. He says no. For months, we've been watching the polls showing that many Bernie Sanders supporters say they won't vote for Hillary in November. And now we have news that some Bernie Sanders supporters are planning to demonstrate outside the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia in July. The city of Philadelphia just granted permits for 4 days of all-day rallies, including one right outside the convention hall, where at least 30,000 Bernie supporters are expected. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. Should add that the organizers of this demonstration are not officially associated with Bernie's campaign. For comment, we turn to Harold Meyerson. He's executive editor of the American Prospect, and he also writes for the LA Times, The Guardian, and other publications. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
The Wall Street Journal is not the best source of news about Bernie supporters, but I think it's true that if Bernie called on his supporters to demonstrate in Philly, he would certainly be able to get 30,000. And you probably remember that the 30,000 is more people than were in the streets in Chicago in 1968 outside the Democratic National Convention. That was the party disaster after which Nixon was narrowly elected. What do you make of this news?
I really think all balls are in the air at the moment. By the time of the convention, there may be some kind of understanding already reached between Bernie and the Bernie camp and the Hillary camp. So it really remains to be seen. And I should add that the appointments made yesterday to the platform drafting committee certainly were a major nod in Bernie's direction. He got 5 appointments, Hillary got 6, and the Democratic National Committee chairperson, Deputy Wasserman Schultz, made 4. But even her appointments really, in many ways, lean to the left. I mean, she appointed Barbara Lee, who represents Oakland and Berkeley in the House, who is probably one of the 2 or 3 leftmost Democrats in the House. So if we're talking about some kind of modus vivendi being reached before the convention or at the convention, I think that was a step in the right direction. Because there's 2 ways these demonstrations can go. They can be, as it were, kind of a celebration of Bernie's achievement and the reminder to the party that the party, you know, and its penumbra or whatever now has there's a big left, and that the Democrats themselves have moved well to the left in the course of the year. or they can be somewhat antagonistic if they see that Hillary is not really moving in the direction of the left more than she has at this point. So it's a little hard to say what exactly these demonstrations are going to be at this juncture.
Let's look at exactly who Bernie's appointments to the platform committee were. I know that he appointed Keith Ellison, congressman from Minneapolis, my hometown. Who else was on that list?
Well, he picked Cornel West, who has never been known to be part of the drafting process for anything that I know of. Cornel West, he's picked the environmental activist Bill McKibben. He picked Native American activist Deborah Parker, and he picked Jim Zogby, who is actually quite a veteran of the Democratic National Committee, also always listed as someone who is a champion of Palestinian rights.
Let me just point out, yeah. Keith Ellison, the first Muslim elected to Congress. Bill McKibben, been a guest on our show more than once. Well, let's take a step back and take a look at what the Bernie campaign has achieved so far. He's gotten almost 10 million votes in the primaries. How does that compare to other socialist candidates in American history?
Well, it certainly validates the strategy of running in the Democratic Party rather than outside, because if you're looking at candidates who ran on the socialist ticket, the high point is Bernie's hero, Eugene V. Debs, in 1912, who got 6% of the vote, which is about a million votes in those days. And then he did rather well while he was imprisoned for having opposed World War One in 1920. And Norman Thomas, running in 1932, got a little under 900,000 votes. And that's sort of the high point of socialist vote getting. So
maybe,
Bernie
maybe
is
we should,
doing much better than that.
Maybe we should also count Henry Wallace, the Progressive Party in 48, got what, about 2 million votes?
Yeah, and about, I think it was about a little over 2.5% of the vote. I think it was less than 2 million, but a little over 2.5% of the vote in the election in which Harry Truman was elected over Republican Thomas Dewey. So there's no question that Bernie has outperformed all of his socialist, or whatever we want to call Henry Wallace, forebears.
And yet we find, to many of us, a shocking degree of aggression and hostility on the part of the so-called Bernie bros on the internet, on Twitter and on the web. Most of it aimed at Hillary and her supporters, something that's very destructive and makes a lot of us unhappy.
Yeah, agreed. And I don't think that's helping Bernie's campaign at all. I know a number of Bernie supporters who have really been put off by this and might vote in California for Hillary in reaction to that, although counteracting that, there's been a huge surge of voter registrations in California this spring, which I think is predominantly Bernie folks. You know, there's kind of a subset of mainly young men texting and Twittering and tweeting that across any political tendency has sort of evolved as a subculture in and of itself. And that subculture, which has developed around Bernie's own campaign, has some of the weaknesses of this subculture generally, you know, a tendency toward snark, viciousness, absolutism, you name it. That is, I am sure, a small percentage of Bernie supporters, among whom I number myself, but it doesn't help. It certainly doesn't help Bernie.
On the question of whether Bernie supporters will vote for Hillary in the fall, Bernie has been perfectly clear about Trump and his own role in this. To quote Bernie Sanders, "A Donald Trump presidency would be a disaster for this country. I will do everything I can to prevent that from happening," close quote. That's pretty decisive. On the other hand, he says whether his supporters will vote for Hillary is, quote, "totally dependent upon her. She is going to have to excite people, convince people that she is, in fact, prepared to go outside of establishment politics and establishment economics, close quote. Do you think he's right about that?
The only word I'd quibble with in that whole statement is entirely, as in entirely up to her. I think Bernie has a role to play, too, but I think there are things that Hillary can do in terms of her vice presidential pick, in terms of the platform, and in terms of the future of Democratic Party rules, where I think she can move in a Bernie-esque direction. And I'm also rather keen on the idea that there are some progressive economic proposals out there that neither of the two candidates owns. For instance, the things that Elizabeth Warren said in a speech a couple days ago at the New America Foundation, where she was talking about giving all workers, whether direct employees or temps or gig workers or whatever, creating kind of universal worker rights and worker benefits, portable benefits that really make sense in our brave new economy, that would be really good for the platform committee or the Democrats to embrace right now. It's a clear move left that wouldn't be seen as a concession by either candidate. Both of them could reach out to some of what Warren was saying, and I think there are grounds for conciliation. And you had referenced at the start the Chicago Convention of 1968. I was at that as an 18-year-old junior staffer for Gene McCarthy, the anti-war candidate. And there was a very bitter fight besides the idiocy of the Chicago police beating up anyone they came across in Grant Park. There was a rather bitter platform fight over the Vietnam War, which was the whole basis of the challenge to the Johnson-Humphrey forces in general. And, that was really, I think, a much wider rift than we're seeing between a lot of the Hillary forces and a lot of the Bernie forces. There's no reason why that level, a 68 level of discontent, need exist, I think, at the forthcoming Democratic convention, which is not to say it won't, but it is to say that I think smart heads on both sides can find ways to avoid that.
So I think it's pretty clear that Hillary voters, or at least many Hillary voters, lean towards Bernie's positions. But what about the party establishment? They're not Bernie people.
Well, I mean, some are. I mean, I think there's a rift between her rank and file supporters and some of the institutional support that that she may be getting from Wall Street and elsewhere. Bernie has shown that you can raise a lot of money without getting a nickel from Wall Street. But there's no question that it's a problem for her, and I think it hurts her politically, as evidenced by that polling result that showed Trump as being far more credible than she with most voters on the question of handling Wall Street, which is just a real indictment of the effect of her being a recipient of donations over the years from Wall Street. It's a real problem, which is why she really does need, I think, to do something like endorse a financial transaction tax. Politically and, also on the merits, she really needs to create some real distance between her and some of her financial and institutional supporters.
Of course, Bernie is out here in California this week and next week campaigning, and the LA Times reported recently that he has stopped attacking Hillary in his stump speech over the last few days. He was in Santa Monica this week. We were at the Santa Monica rally and saw the same thing. The only attack on Hillary in his stump speech referred to that day's news that she had refused the invitation to debate him before the California primary. He called that disappointing but not surprising, but he didn't talk about her fees from Goldman Sachs. He didn't talk about the fact that she doesn't support $15 an hour minimum wage. He didn't talk about her past support for trade agreements. He just laid out his own positions, contrasted them to the Republicans. So it seems like Bernie himself is pointing the direction that you are suggesting.
Yeah, I think so. And I think he probably also feels that the appointments to the platform drafting committee are sort of a signal from the other side that maybe what he's now saying and backing off some of the Hillary attacks, that this has been acknowledged and reciprocated. There was a significant a piece written by Nate Silver recently of the 538 website talking about a high percentage of the independents who register as independents and are up for grabs in polling between Trump and Clinton are actually Bernie backers, not necessarily moderates, centrists, center-rightists to Hillary's right. And so there's a strategic logic for November, I think, in her bolstering, those kinds of positions. I would also add that in today's Wall Street Journal, they broke out some questions on comparisons in their poll between Trump and Hillary. And on the question of who would deal with Wall Street better, Trump outdistanced her by 21%, meaning that, if she could bring herself to endorse some of the Bernie proposals, like for a financial transaction tax or other things that would be seen as reigning in Wall Street, that would, she's really got nowhere to go but up on that, and she needs to.
Harold Meyerson, you can read his piece, How the Bros Are Undermining Bernie, at the American Prospect website, prospect.org. Thank you, Harold.
Thank you, John.
The pollsters tell us Hillary is still the most likely candidate to be elected president in November. And one of the things she has emphasized during the campaign is her record as Secretary of State helping poor women around the world. For comment, we turn to Tom Frank. Of course, he wrote the classic book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And also Pity the Billionaire and The Wrecking Crew. He's a former columnist for the Wall Street Journal and Harper's, and now he writes about politics for Salon. And he has a new book out. It's called Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. I asked Tom Frank about Hillary's work as Secretary of State, especially her program for poor women around the world. It was called The Hillary Doctrine.
She had two big initiatives as Secretary of State that intrigued me. And by the way, John, I was surprised when I was writing this book that there are very few people that actually examined what she did as Secretary of State, apart from the wars.
Yeah.
Apart from the wars that she was always urging us to get into, people haven't really looked at what she brought to the State Department. But she had two things. One was what she called internet freedom. And the other is they called the Hillary Doctrine. And internet freedom is, I mean, you know what it is, right? It's that everybody on the planet has a human right to Google things. You have a right to be tracked by Google, right? and therefore we need to get a computer in the hands of every man, woman, and child in the world. But the Hillary Doctrine is the one that really intrigues me. And this is... it just went by relatively without notice from the American pundit corps, but Hillary Clinton declared that the United States was henceforth to be the world's protector of women and girls. Okay, and that sounds like a strange shift, but in fact it's sort of a piece with the Bush administration's war on radical Islam. In fact, the Bush administration was sort of evolving towards making this kind of feminism, to rationalizing its various wars in the name of feminism. And Hillary sort of picked up where that left off. But she would give these very prominent speeches, TED Talks and that kind of thing, about how we needed to defend women and girls worldwide.
Let me quote from one of those from your book. The subjugation of women is a threat to the common security of our world and to the national security of our country, close quote. Wow. What do we usually do when our national security is threatened?
Launch the missiles, slap the trade embargoes on, you put the quarantine around Cuba, It sounds like a really big deal. When I watched that speech, and by the way, this was in a TED Talk. I was watching that speech, it's like, am I hearing World War III declared from a TED Talk? I mean, that would be just the consummation of this, the kind of liberalism that I'm writing about in this book. But no, that's not what she meant at all. Of course, she just was just talking big. What she actually meant was that. And she didn't even mean that we would be supportive of all women. She mainly meant that we would be supportive of women entrepreneurs around the world.
And how? How are we supposed to help women become entrepreneurs?
Well, this is kind of an interesting thing. That one of the she's of course extremely vague about all of this, it's never really nailed down. You say nice things about them, but another thing that you do is you encourage what's called microlending. And this is, again, this is not a well-known idea here in America. It's not a well-known phenomenon, but it's Hillary has talked about it basically her entire adult life. If you go back to her days as first lady in the Bill Clinton administration, she used to go around the world promoting microlending. And what it is, the idea is that you give small entrepreneurs, and specifically women, you give them tiny little loans, you know, like $100 or something like that, so they can start their own business. And it's often touted as the solution to poverty. And in the 1990s, when, you know, the World Bank and the IMF were basically going around the world structural adjustment was the term.
Yes.
Structurally adjusting everybody's economy. You know, these countries would say, yeah, but your structural adjustments, you know, the deregulation and the privatization, this is going to ruin us. And the World Bank would say, ah, but we'll solve that problem by giving you microloans. Okay.
Passing out $100 checks to a few poor women.
Yeah, but now this is not charity, you understand. This is a loan. They have to pay it back. So that it's making them into debtors. Now, I'm going to make a long story very short, but you know, your listeners can basically guess by now. In the 90s, this was supposed to be the silver bullet for poverty. And, you know, it was a win-win. The lender made money. The women entrepreneurs became millionaires, right? Everybody won, right? No, it was another colossal failure. But weirdly, that didn't come out until very recently. The entire sort of global financial community would talk about this idea of microlending as though it were this perfect solution for everything. And the big American foundations, the NGOs, all of these people were on board with it. But now we know, thanks to a number of researchers in the UK, this thing is it's complete rubbish. It doesn't work at all. It doesn't empower these women. It makes them into debtors. And, you know, the businesses that they start, it's always the same kind of thing. It's like, you know, I'm going to sell the milk from my goat, or I'm going to raise vegetables in my garden, or I'm going to make, toys out of scrap metal. This is not how you employ people in an economy. You know, this is like, in terms of job creation, this is nothing. It's completely ineffective. And one of the researchers that I was reading compared it to the communism, because they're doing this now, by the way, in Bosnia. Bosnia is where America obviously has enormous influence. Bosnia is saturated with microloans. And you have on the one hand these sort of micro-lending millionaires, you know, the people who hand out the loans, the sort of local bankers. And then on the other hand, you have all these people indebted to them. And the country is it's a disaster zone. And the people there actually look back to the days of communism with fondness, you know. The five-year plans, the factories, the tractors, you know, that actually worked compared to this.
In your book, Listen Liberal, you have a very powerful critique of Hillary's kind of microloans. You talk about the alternative that it replaces.
Yeah, any kind of collective action by the people who live there.
Yeah.
It's all the whole principle of microlending is that you will we will cure the economy and we will solve poverty and all this stuff through individual effort. So no labor unions, no governments coming in to organize things, nothing like that. It's all you as a small entrepreneur pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Now, I want to stop for a second here, John, and remind the listeners that we're talking about Democrats here. We're talking about liberals. This is not Republicans. This is a very, very liberal idea. This is the idea that, all the liberal foundations are into. They spend millions and millions of dollars on this. There are companies that they bankroll. The companies make money off of the microloans. By the way, the microloans are often usurious, you know, like 100% interest, that kind of thing. This is all over the place, and it is a huge, colossal failure. It's also just, I mean, you know it's going to fail when you set up as your solution to poverty something that's not going to cost anybody anything. You know, you're just going to hand out small loans and tell these people that they have to become entrepreneurs. It's basically one step up from doing nothing, you know, doing nothing for these people. It fails. But that's Hillary's solution to inequality. That's it.
Let's talk about the Global Microcredit Summit in Washington, D.C., back in 97, which Hillary co-hosted. You have a vivid picture of how the Microcredit Summit in Washington ended.
Yeah. And, you know, this is, of course, an occasion where bankers, because obviously microlending is of great interest to banks, banks get together with the sort of representatives of the third world, and they hold hands and sing, sing songs together. And on this particular occasion, the song they sang was "We Shall Overcome."
Oh.
I know.
The world's bankers.
Yes,
hold hands
and there was
sing.
A representative of Citicorp who was there. You know, Citibank, and this is what he said. He said to all the people there in the room, everyone in this room is a banker because everyone here is banking on self-employment to help alleviate poverty around the world. Yes. And this is, and then over the years, by the way, I studied microlending. Over the years, you can sort of watch as this idea, you know, it's a favorite foundation hobby horse, but as this idea sort of picks up these different refinements and details, like the loans must go to women, not men. And so women are better entrepreneurs than men. But women have to have, the entrepreneurs have to have mentors back in the West, in the United States or in England or somewhere like that. No, wait, there's one more thing. The entrepreneurs have to have a smartphone to connect them to their bank, right? They have to be on the internet. And so it collect all of these neat little details over the years, but none of it really made any difference. But then the sort of culmination of it is I went to a Hillary Clinton event just about exactly a year ago right now. I went to a Hillary Clinton event in New York City. It was a Clinton Foundation event with Hillary was the MC. And you know, there was lots of talk about this, and you see the same thing there as at that Micro Summit Credit in Washington in 1997. This very sort of high idealism, very noble. This sort of, I call it the microclimate of virtue that always surrounds Hillary Clinton. Is everybody is so good, you know what I mean? They're such fine, fine individuals. The co-host of it, by the way, this time was Melinda Gates, the richest woman in the world.
Yes.
So it's Hillary and Melinda Gates, and then this all of these very, very poor women from the third world, you know. And I was sitting there in the audience watching this and thinking, what is the connection between these two groups, you know, the American women talking about, you know, smashing the glass ceiling. You know, this is Hillary's great great line, and then these entrepreneurs from the third world who've got themselves a microloan and have managed to succeed. And it was fascinating. And what's even more fascinating is when you think about what's missing from that picture. You know, that's Hillary's worldview. That's how she understands, you know, inequality. But there's something missing from it. And what's missing, I mean, obviously, American working women, you know, her own people that live in this country and who had the floor basically pulled out from under them with welfare reform in 1996.
Tom Frank, his new book is Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Tom, thanks for talking with us today.
You got it, John.
A lot of people see independent voters as the key to this election, When pollsters ask voters whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or independents, the largest group says they're independents, 39%. Democrats are 32%. Republicans are a tiny, pathetic 23%. Trump says he's won the independents, and that's going to make him president. Bernie, of course, says he has won the independents. For comment and analysis, we turn to Joshua Holland. He writes for The Nation. He's a fellow at The Nation Institute, and he's the host of Politics and Reality Radio. Joshua Holland, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, the big question is, who are the independents, and how independent are they really?
Well, we have to start with the obvious reality that they are a heterodox bunch. But the thing that a lot of political commentators get wrong is this assumption that they're thoughtful independents, that they're up for grabs by either party, and that the parties have to win over independents in order to win elections. What we see is that the vast majority of independents, all but maybe 5% of the electorate, are not swing voters. They are reliable voters for one party or another. They tend to be slightly less engaged in politics. They're slightly less likely to vote at all. But they're not, you know, people who are in the middle who can vote for a Republican one year, vote for a Democrat in the following election. There is a share of those people. Again, they're about 5%.
So when you include leaners among those independents with the rest of the electorate, what does the party breakdown look like?
Well, using that same data from Pew, which is a year old, a year ago they found that the Democrats and Democratic leaners made up 48% of the electorate. Republicans and Republican leaners made up 39% of the electorate. And then in that study, you had 12 or 13% who refuse to identify one way or the other.
So let's talk about Trump. He claims to have brought millions and millions of new people into the Republican Party from the ranks of independents. And the people Trump beat in the primaries agree with that. They've been saying Trump won because independents flipped the scales in what otherwise would have been a close contest among Republicans. What do you think about that?
Well, the I think it was the Washington Post did an analysis of exit poll data, and what they found was that the so-called new voters that Donald Trump says that he is bringing into the Republican Party, many of them, most of them, have not voted in primaries in the past, so they're not reliable primary voters, but they are in fact not new to the Republican Party, nor are they new to voting for Republicans in the general election. It's one of these like interesting trivia things. The fact that you're getting people to turn out for the primary certainly may help you in the primary, but it's not in any way indicative of how you're going to fare in the general election, given that there are already people who are going to vote for the Republican.
Turning to Bernie, Bernie has made a strong case that it's the open Democratic primaries where he's done the best because he can recruit the independents. California primary coming up shortly. Independents are allowed to vote in the Democratic primary. What do you think of Bernie's argument?
Two things. First of all, Sanders has won 8 out of the 19 open primaries. So it's not like he's a sure thing or a slam dunk in open primaries. He's lost more of them than he's won. But the important thing to understand here is that Bernie has dominated among independents, and this is largely a result of the demographics. So if you look at who is most likely to identify as an independent, by about 20 points, it's millennials. It's young people. White people are more likely to identify as an independent than black people. Men are more likely to identify as an independent than women. So, you know, you look at the two candidates' coalitions, you know, there has been an age gap, there has been a gender gap, and there has been a white-black gap, or a gap in ethnicity or race. So, you know, I think that there's no denying that Sanders has done extremely well with independents, but again, this is just another way of looking at the coalitions that appear to skew towards these two candidates. There's nothing unique about this group as far as their ideology or how they think. And one of the interesting things I would add to this is this. If you look at ideology, Sanders' Democratic supporters are far more liberal than Hillary Clinton's Democratic supporters. But if you look at Sanders' independent supporters and Hillary Clinton's independent supporters, there's virtually no ideological space between them.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, fun with trivia. But I mean, that's the whole thing is that this is interesting demographic trivia rather than some profound category of voters that we have to think about as being unique in our political system. They're not unique. They tend to be they're political scientists call them closet partisans, right? They don't want to say I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican. And a key part of that is that as our politics have become increasingly nasty, increasingly personal, as we've grown further apart and more polarized, a lot of them are just turned off by identifying with one party or another. So they'll go out and they'll vote every time for Republican, or they'll go out and vote every time for Democrat, but they don't want to call themselves Democrats. They don't want to call themselves Republicans because they think that the partisan combat is ugly.
So if independents are not really independent, if most of them are committed partisans who have stable patterns of voting for the same party over the years, and really the only ones who matter are the so-called independents in the, what, 6 or 8 swing states, what does that mean for this election? What does it mean for Trump? What does it mean for the Democrats?
In this election and in other recent elections, what we've seen is that the two parties have excelled and increasingly excelled at identifying their voters and turning them out. And when I say their voters, I mean their registered partisans and also the independents who lean towards their party. So, you know, it's become such a sophisticated game to turn out your voters that the parties are putting less emphasis on persuading that very small and decreasing group that are up for grabs in the middle, the 5% or so who are what political science is called floating voters, the genuine swing voters. So if you're going to invest resources in your campaign and trying to win, it's more cost effective to get out your own people who might be less motivated to go to the polls, might be busy, might have other things in their lives, than it is to try to actually win over those folks who are up for grabs.
We are told that this election is different because the independents who support Bernie are more likely to vote for the Republican candidate this year than has been the case in past contested Democratic primaries, that there is an overlap between support for Bernie and potential support for Trump of a kind we haven't seen before. There's some poll evidence. One poll shows only 66% of Sanders backers said they would support Hillary in November. Another poll found 20% of Sanders supporters said they would vote for Trump in November rather than Clinton. You wrote a piece for thenation.com, I think 2 months ago, where the headline was, "Relax, Bernie's supporters will back Hillary if she's the nominee." Are you still relaxed about the Bernie supporters' vote in November?
that's a good question. Well, I'm always nervous about these elections, and I'm not panicking, and I am very confident that the process of party unification that we've seen in the past is gonna play out as it always does, especially because we're talking about Donald Trump. He's such a polarizing force. I believe that Sanders is going to extract some additional concessions. We've already seen that starting with Sanders having picks on the platform committee this week. I'm pretty confident that Sanders is going to get some more stuff out of her, and then he is going to endorse her, and then he's going to campaign for her. And in that piece, I noted that the number of Sanders supporters who say that they won't vote for Clinton is significantly less than Clinton supporters who said that they would not vote for Obama in 2008.
Well, what Bernie has said this time around, quoting him, "I will do everything that I can to prevent Trump from being elected. That would be a disaster for this country." But he went on to say, whether his supporters will vote for Hillary, quote, "is totally dependent upon her," close quote. If she doesn't adopt the kind of positions that he has expressed to mobilize his supporters, Bernie Sanders says his supporters, many of his supporters, won't vote for her. Do you think that's true?
We're in a hotly contested primary season. So Sanders supporters, I count myself among them, I am a Sanders supporter, are looking at Clinton on one side and Sanders on the other, and they like what they see on the Sanders side, and they don't really like what they see on the Clinton side. When we get to the general election, you're just going to have a starkly different set of choices before you. You're going to have Hillary on one side and Donald Trump on the other. And I'm really not worried about party unification in light of that, those contrasts being apparent during a general election.
Last question. What do you think about the chances for party unification on the Republican side? We've seen unprecedented opposition from the leaders of the party, from the past candidates, from the previous Republican presidents to Trump. Do you think there'll be party unification of the traditional kind for behind Trump?
To some degree, you're already seeing it, and that's clear in the polls. Trump's favorability is increasing. Those favorability numbers are not increasing among Democrats, and they're not increasing among Dem-leaning independents. They're increasing among Republicans. I believe that Trump is, as a non-mainstream candidate, will be a bit of an exception in the sense that even a small share of Republican women are going to be turned off in a visceral sense to his misogyny. And I think that partisanship and negative partisanship especially is a really powerful force, but there's a share of Republican women out there that are just not going to be able to countenance it. And it doesn't have to be a large share to create a very disparate impact in the electoral college, right? If 5% of Republican women stay home in Ohio and Florida and Virginia, it's going to be a very lopsided result.
Joshua Holland, he's got the facts. Read him at thenation.com. Listen to him on Politics and Reality Radio on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Joshua, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Start Making Sense, the Nation podcast, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books. Our senior producer at Start Making Sense is Alan Minsky. Our executive producer is Frank Reynolds. Our recording engineer is Ernesto Orellano. Our engagement editor is Annie Shields. Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. Find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com and subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts, at Stitcher, SoundCloud, or iTunes. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.